So, I think the title of my talk was not given. The theme for the day is the goal. You could argue that I am talking about the goal, and I will mention it at some point. But the theme of the whole convention, I think, wasn't it the Bodhisattva principle and insight, or something like this. So the idea was I should talk about the Bodhisattva principle, because in the organizing Skype calls, I kept saying again and again, but we have a different Bodhisattva ideal. And so in a sense, what I'm talking about is our Bodhisattva ideal. Oops, it would help if I started on page one, but that's another point. Okay. Now, you've all heard about the Bodhisattva ideal, probably from the very first encounters with the movement. I remember in the summer retreat many, many years ago, we listened to the talks, and Ratnaguna was there, and Pragnananda was there, and we listened to Bhante's talks on the Bodhisattva ideal. And in a winter retreat in Padmaloka a bit later, we were listening to them again. Satyaraja was there, Dharmananda was there, I remember, and we were listening to the talks in the evenings. Or if you got involved a bit later, you probably read about it. You read the Bodhisattva ideal book, or you had to study it, and probably most of you have taught about the Bodhisattva as well. And you could probably, if called upon, you could write like that, start to talk about the Bodhisattva and what it is. Even if you were, well, of course, none of you would ever be found half drunk, but let's say you could explain it in your sleep, probably, what the Bodhisattva ideal is. But probably very, very few of us have ever bothered to explain the traditional Bodhisattva career. The traditional Bodhisattva career. And what I mean by that is the idea that at some point one encounters a Buddha and makes the choice of which of the three paths to take. The path of personal liberation without compassion, becoming the Shravakayana, to become an arahat in the narrow sense. The path of personal liberation, but full liberation, become a private Buddha or Pratyeka Buddha. Or the path for a liberation for the sake of all, becoming a Samyaksam Buddha, a full Buddha. And then following on that, the decision, of course, in the Bodhisattva, or the putative Bodhisattva, is, of course, to follow the third path. He takes his vow. A Buddha predicts him to full enlightenment, perhaps of the name. The full bodhicitta arises, etc., etc. And over innumerable lifetimes, he practices for the sake of all beings, whether the six or the ten paramitas, developing his stocks of merit and his stocks of wisdom, going to the hells, enduring suffering for the sake of all beings, traversing the ten bhumis, and at the eighth bhumi he becomes irreversible. He cannot fall back and become merely an arhat. And at a time in which the Dharma has been completely lost, at a time at which there is no Buddha, without a teacher, in his last lifetime, he rediscovers the Dharma and teaches it. So I think I've never actually explained that before, and I've been teaching the Dharma for 35 years now. But this is actually an integral part of the traditional Bodhisattva idea, a traditional Bodhisattva ideal. Just raise your hand. How many of you teach this, teach what I've just explained, teach the tradition? One. I'm surprised it's that many. Two. Okay, Ratnaguna. Okay. Well, I don't think we practice it. I don't think we even try to practice it. And I don't think that Bhante teaches that either. In fact, certain key elements of it, such as the vows and the whole cosmic, this kind of perspective over many lifetimes, he has referred to as spiritual inflation or a fantasy spiritual life. But it is an integral part of the Bodhisattva tradition. So what is our version of it, if that, I'm claiming, is not our version? Well, our version is not to be found in the survey, because it's something that Bhante gradually came to. In the survey, he gives a very traditional version based on the Dashabhumika Sutra to a large extent. It's not to be found in the Bodhisattva series of lectures. Do not confuse that with the book, The Bodhisattva Ideal, because that is, in my not that humble opinion, is a not-so-successful integration of the lectures with the later seminar material. And it's in the seminar material and in Bhante's questions and answers that he lays out his understanding of what the Bodhisattva Ideal really is. And I first consciously encountered it on my ordination retreat in Tuscany 81, where Banti talked again and again that there's really only one goal. Ratnaguna was there. He may remember that. And Pragnananda was there. And there's only one goal. And that's a goal that combines compassion and wisdom. In fact, he talked more than once that, in fact, you cannot really distinguish the two. That when we talk of wisdom, or even using the traditional term, one tends to think of it as something conceptual and cognitive, which he saw as an error, but an understandable error. And when you talk of compassion, we tend to think of it as emotion, which is just as much of an error. Or putting it another way, it's as legitimate to describe the goal is in emotional terms as in the more traditional cognitive terms. They are equally valid and invalid formulations. A certain gentleman who was ordained a bit later kept questioning Banti if it was not, after all, possible to become an arahat in the narrower sense, to strive for personal liberation for himself, ignoring all others. And with his usual patience, Banti denied the possibilities again and again and again, on the grounds that this, what he calls a deformed arahat ideal, does not exist. It is no possibility to become liberated without taking others into account. So you could say, in a sense, the goal or the primary means to achieve the goal is not the development of wisdom and compassion, but of something like compassion hyphen wisdom. A bit like some translators translate citta as heart hyphen mind, which is very ugly, but at least it tries to convey the idea that mind distorts it and heart distorts it, well, in many contexts. So you can find many, many quotations from Banti in the seminars where he goes into this point or different aspects of it. So one, in fact, you can't have a spiritual life without that dimension, the factor of compassion. So it's not just the goal, it's the whole spiritual life. Or, my point is that you cannot really have any other kind of enlightenment than enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Or a bit later on in one seminar, I'm saying that any kind of insight or enlightenment experience per se involves the experience or presence of compassion, which goes directly against Theravada teaching, at least against Abhidharma teaching. So the way I often put it personally, in a slightly crude way, when people ask me about that, is I say, well, there's an inherent contradiction if you're striving for insight into the not I, in terms of I am trying to see through my illusion of my permanent self, that you're bound, you're hitting a contradiction in there. It cannot work. Banti explains that more philosophically in a seminar quote that became very well known in the, must have been around 1979 or 80, in the Mitrata Self and Other. And it's called the Bitendential Value of Being. Some of you will immediately recognize that as a typical phrase by Herbert Günther. In the context, I'm going to read two paragraphs from it. Being, with a capital B, is more or less a synonym for reality. So Banti talks about it. In the realm of ultimate reality, there is no subject-object division. It's as though on the level of empirical reality, on the level of ordinary experience, you need a double approach. Reality has bifurcated into subject and object, self and other. So you are to approach reality not only via the subject, but via the object. In fact, in a sense, the best way to approach the bitendential reality is via the object, rather than via the subject, because to do things via the subject, as it were, is your natural one-sided tendency. Even if you approach what you consider to be reality, it is still just you approaching. The approach still takes place within the basic dichotomy. You are still doing something for yourself, which is a contradiction in terms. So therefore, the altruistic approach is as necessary as the self-regarding approach. You are sort of making a true two-pronged attack on reality. You have, as it were, to gain being not only for yourself, but for others. Otherwise, you, do not gain reality at all because you cannot. It is only you plus others who can. So when you plus others attain reality, that is, the bi-tendential value of being which has been realized, prajna representing your attainment and karuna representing their attainment. If you approach the non-dual reality from the standpoint of subject, your experience culminates in prajna. If you approach from the standpoint of the other, your experience culminates in karuna. And these two coalesce. They form one value of ultimate reality. To put it very simply and practically, it is not enough to just sit there in your meditation. You've actually got to go out and act unselfishly, which brings in the ethical, the other-oriented dimension. It is that only which will break down the barrier, as it were, between subject and object. You quite literally cannot realize reality by yourself. That isn't even a possibility. This is what the Bodhisattva sees when he gives up the idea of individual nirvana. There is no nirvana for me as distinct from a nirvana for them. Well, I hope that wasn't too long. You can always reference it again. I've always been inspired by that passage. But I think we sometimes don't look at the implications. First of all, it collapses the entire scheme of the bhumis, of the 10 steps listed by the Dashabhumika Sutra. Because step 8, irreversibility, becomes meaningless. What are you in danger of falling back to? A personal liberation which doesn't exist? And in fact, the Mahayana progressive steps becomes rather meaningless there. Secondly, it also dissolves the scheme of the three paths. It becomes merely a didactic method. There are no three paths. There are no three goals. What Bhante is effectively arguing is the very nature of reality means there's only one path and goal, which is the altruistic one, taking into account other beings. There are no arhats in the degenerate sense. There is only one goal, awakening for the sake of all. So, what does that leave of the traditional bodhisattva ideal? Well, you've probably all heard or read Bhante's lecture, The Origin of the Bodhisattva Ideal, in which he discusses various characteristics of the Buddha's character. And if you haven't actually heard it, I would strongly recommend listening to Bhante speaking of this, because the way in which he describes Ananda at the Buddha's death, or the Kissa Gotami episode, I think actually demonstrates someone who is infused by the Bodhisattva spirit speaking. And in it, the main point he's making in the lecture, the origin of the Bodhisattva ideal is in the life and example of the Buddha. So he's saying that the teaching of the Buddha consists not just of the word of the Buddha, what the Buddha said, but also what the Buddha did, his example, the selfless life for the Dharma. So I think that's one of the main aspects of the traditional ideal that we do still have, this example of the selfless life for the Dharma. And it's no coincidence that Bhante has praised and referred to Dardo Rinpoche again and again as perhaps the closest exemplar to a bodhisattva that he ever encountered, a person who lived selflessly for the Dharma. So we're not taking on the traditional detail of the bodhisattva's career, but the spirit of the bodhisattva, the emphasis on spiritual altruism, on unselfishness, and on compassion, or at least on metta. And by metta, I mean not just the well-wishing in theory or mentally, but in action. Or as Bhante's put it again and again, just be kind, be helpful, behave in that way. Don't just talk about it. Now, what consequences does that have? You can put it in various ways. Well, one consequence you could say is just, in order to practice Buddhism, you need the Bodhisattva attitude. Or putting it more radically, you could even argue, forget about the bodhisattva path because there is no other path. There's just Buddhism. And that happens to be what we were calling the bodhisattva attitude before. If you want to achieve the Buddhist goal for yourself, well, you have to achieve it also for others. Otherwise, no progress, no real progress. The only real goal is enlightenment or stream entry or the arising of the bodhicitta, both for self and others. Putting it again a slightly different way, the penetrative insight that one wants to get through spiritual death or liberation unchained or whatever it might be is wisdom compassion. You cannot just have wisdom without compassion. This is not the classical bodhisattva career. Be aware of that, though. It's more like the path taken by the historical disciples of the historical Buddha. You could say it's roughly, this is very, very imprecise, like the path taken by the arhats described in the Pali Canon, whom Bhante has pointed out again and again, are nothing like the arahants described later in Mahayana sutras. So it's like them, but of course without the presence of the historical Buddha. But with the idea of the bodhisattva made explicitly formulated and presented. And also still with the rich myths of the Mahayana and the transcendental bodhisattvas and archetypal Buddhas. Yes, in the last couple of years, we've been made aware, thanks to Bhante and Subhuti, of the limitations of our dependence on traditional Indo-Tibetan mythology, cosmology, and images. But we need, whether or not them, something like them very, very much as nourishment for our imagination, especially given not just Western, but generally modern conditioning and materialism. And for now, at least, the Mahayana sutras, with their emphasis on the bodhisattvas, present an opening, an inspiration, part of the glorious vision of transcendental beings. On a practical level, as Bhante's pointed out again and again, we have the Pali Canon, and more we have the equivalents from the Chinese Canon in English translation as well. Very sober, very practical. But I personally think they don't do enough for the kind of materialist philosophy that we're inoculated with, or rather poisoned by, from birth in the modern world. And the Mahayana Sutras provide us more with an anti-materialist antidote. The bodhisattva spirit itself is an antidote to the modern obsession with oneself. It gives us more the perception of concern for others. Well, how does this affect one's practice? Well, my experience of myself is that I'm not an altruistic person. Compassion is something I'd like to have experience somebody else as being compassionate towards me. Otherwise, I tend to be a bit impatient with the people who are being so stupid around me, of course. But very early on in doing the Metta Bhavana, I found I actually enjoyed having positive feelings towards other people. I found it quite hedonistic. I happen to like pleasures. So I enjoyed discovering that you could really feel happier by concerning yourself more for other people. So what I did is I really learnt the advantages of what we call it enlightened egotism. So it's a kind of altruistic activity, but the motives are basically selfish. You discover you are happier if you concern yourself with others. But my experience, and it's not unique, is, well, even if that was my rather lowly motive for initially practicing Dharma, and more specifically things like the Metta Bhavana, I gradually noticed just finding it wonderful to be able to help others in enjoying their happiness. Now, this is, of course, reflected in the precepts, especially looking at the precepts in the special way. I have to admit with shame, I never picked it up in my ordination retreat, but years later, supporting a course in Guhya Loka, Padmavajra pointed out Bhante's emphasis that the cutting edge of the order member's daily practice should be the positive side of the precepts. And I put that together with one of his key teachings in the Ten Pillars, that the key precept is, of course, the first precept. So you end up with the positive side of the first precept, with deeds of loving kindness. Well, that simply means helping people. Helping people. Of course, one of the best means of helping people is giving, giving different things. So helping and giving. And putting it a bit simplistically, well, that is our bodhisattva ideal on an everyday level. Helping and giving. And of course, what is seen traditionally as the highest gift, the best way to help people, dharma dana, giving the gift of the dharma. Now, I found it very interesting. I think about 5 years ago, I wandered off to Birken Forest Monastery in Western Canada. I wasn't going there for the teaching. It was part of Ajahn Chah's tradition, but because of the meditation conditions. It's a bit of a side note. It's the best shrine room I've ever been in terms of meditating. And let's put it, in the 2 weeks I was there, I heard cars once and wolves twice, which I think is a good proportion for a shrine room. Yeah. No, the wolves were outside the shrine room at any rate, yes. And there was a session in the afternoon. Everything was in silence, but the abbot answered questions. And in one question he was answering, because he was obviously very, very into his meditation, an American up there in that part of Canada, serving as abbot there. And he'd really got involved in eastern Thailand. And after his ordination as a full monk, he moved to another monastery to meditate under a very famous meditation abbot, who promptly took him out of the meditation kuti and had him teach people. Not meditation, teach dharma. That was his next step in order to deepen his meditation, giving the gift of the dharma. It's also quite interesting, in the around 1800, the famous Tibetan saint Shabkar, if you're not familiar with him, he's sometimes referred to as the second Milarepa, who was a Nyingma practitioner, extremely fond of long solitary retreats, was told by his teachers, no, just teach. To make progress, teach. Some of you are familiar perhaps with Analayo's, you might say, second book, the first book being the one on mindfulness that probably most of us are familiar with. His second book is The Genesis of the Bodhisattva Ideal. His main theme is that the historical Buddha was not motivated by compassion on his search for enlightenment. Now, that's a different topic, but what's very interesting is he points out that after his enlightenment, not only did the Buddha teach, not only did he urge his enlightened disciples to teach in the famous saying to the 61 of Bahujana Hitaya, for the sake of the many, he instructed his unenlightened pupils to teach. In fact, he admonished the ones who failed to teach. And in the footnotes, Analayo refers to at least three different Nikayas in which this crops up, and two different Agamas from the Chinese tradition. So there's apparently many references in the Pali Canon to the Buddha explicitly telling his pupils, whether unenlightened or enlightened, to teach, that that was part of their path. And there's several references, apparently, with the Buddha explicitly telling people that by teaching and during teaching they can gain enlightenment. So, spiritual altruism, or the bodhisattva spirit, is essential for real insight, traditionally and in Bhante's laying out of it. In fact, Bhante refers to the idea of a path of personal individual enlightenment as a deformation of Buddhism. A deformation. So, spiritual altruism is not just essential, it's also effective. If you think about it, in the phase of spiritual death that we've been talking about so much, generally people have been concerned about insight meditation practices. Now, spurred on by a reference that Vasantra made to the order survey, which shows something like 1% or 2% of order members as doing the six-element practice on any sort of regular basis, I asked Bhante, well, what else can one do outside of meditation? Because you've emphasized that the path does not just consist of meditation. And he simply said, helping people, unselfish activity is an insight practice. Mm-hmm. And to my surprise, I discovered in notes I'd made 5 years early in a talk he'd given in Essen, explicitly talking about unselfish activity as a path of insight within the stage of spiritual death. So just summing up what I'm saying here, we have a version of the Bodhisattva ideal which is not the traditional one. But it's also not an option. It's not an option if you want to practice Buddhism. Putting it perhaps very bluntly, unless you follow the Bodhisattva path, you're not following Buddhism. I'll conclude with a quote or part of a short poem by Shabkar. If a man has compassion, he is a Buddha. Without compassion, he is a lord of death. With compassion, the root of Dharma is planted. Without compassion, the root of Dharma is rotten. One with compassion is kind even when angry. One without compassion will kill even as he smiles. For one with compassion, even his enemies will turn into friends. Without compassion, even his friends turn into enemies. With compassion, one has all dharmas. Without compassion, one has no dharma at all. With compassion, one is a Buddhist. Without compassion, one is worse than a heretic. Even if meditating on voidness, one needs compassion as its essence. Compassion is the distinctive characteristic of Buddhism. Compassion is the very essence of all dharmas. Great compassion is like a wish-fulfilling gem. Great compassion will fulfill the hopes of self and others. Therefore, all of you, practitioners and lay people, cultivate compassion and you will achieve Buddhahood. May all men and women who hear this song with great compassion benefit all beings.